Session number 20937, Reel 4.
Neville Howell, Reel 4.
Yes, we could winch these anti-tank guns up onto these portees, the lorries, if you like, which carried them. We could winch them up and face them forward, winch them up and face them back. We stayed with ours on portee, which meant we were not particularly committed to putting them into a gun pit and then sending the vehicles back to the rear out of harm's way until the next day. And I was ordered again to into the same part where the previous day we'd seen part of our battery going up on mines, vehicle mines, where some of them were injured. And my troop were ordered to occupy this piece of ground the next day and dig a gun pit. We did. We didn't lose anybody on mines, so we were lucky. We picked up quite a bit of shell fire. Obviously, we were being observed from somewhere. And yes, we occupied for the rest of that day. Pulled out again the next day from those positions and were sent further to the further south on in the line, the further south than we'd ever been before. We'd been up down the Alamone line as such, and now we were sent right down the southern part. And whilst there, we had to go up on a hill, very high hill, and we went up there at night time on this hill. And come the morning, but of course we always stood to in the morning, we found we were high up above an escarpment down below. And I take it that that part down below, part of it formed what was known as the Katara Depression, which is referred to as a sand sea, I believe, because it was difficult for vehicles at times to make their way through it. That is the extreme southern part of the Alamein line. And whilst there, on this first morning there, we saw aircraft coming towards us from what would be the German positions. We recognised them as being Mitchell bombers. There are about a dozen of them. And the German ACAC was firing at them as they came back towards us. We were not very high. We, on this hill, if you like, were almost up level with them on the top of this hill. It seems remarkable, but we were up very high on the top of this particular position. And one of these bombers started to drop even lower and drop to the rear of this group. And then we saw a parachute. So they were obviously bailing out of this one lone Mitchell bomber. And at the same time, the aircraft started to turn. It was still losing height until it was level with us. It started to turn right round. Other crew members came out. I think we saw another four drop out from it. So about four came out of it. And as it was then level with us, almost level with us for height, going back in the direction from which it had come, I saw the figure of a man come out. There must have been a doorway halfway along the fuselage. I could see the figure of a man come out to that doorway. And as he left the aircraft, he must have thought he wasn't very high at all. He must have released his parachute. It stuck on the tail of the aircraft. And the aircraft then started to go down more steeply towards the German lines, with him streaming out behind it. I'm certain it was the pilot who'd left till last, and that he'd obviously released his chute the moment he came out the door. Unfortunately, he stayed with the aircraft, of course, being towed along by it and hit the ground where there was an explosion. And yes, that was a shame, but there we are. Well, I did see the other crew were being picked up by vehicles that went off. I could see them going out into the desert to pick them up. We then, soon after that, went northwards on the line again, went back to where the main party was on, if you like. And we were assigned to do another tack at night time. I believe it was a Scottish regiment we were in support of this time. It entailed going up, there was a long slope of ground rising up. This is night time. Barrage was going all the time. Became very dusty. We then had to turn right and make our way through a minefield, which had been taped by the engineers. We knew this all beforehand, that they would be taping a path through this minefield. And partway through the minefield, the column, and I say column, we had to keep closed up at night time in these conditions because so much dust was, and apart from smoke, you could hardly see. And unfortunately, as we'd seen it happen to a minor extent before, the tapes on the minefields become covered in dust and become invisible up to a point. And we, together with my driver, I was staring ahead trying to see the next vehicle in front, if you like, and where we thought we should turn left, we turned left, but we joined these other vehicles of the troop, my troop, if you wish. And there was a, and I was standing up on the front of my portee. My seat was immediately above the front wheel of the portee. The engine in these portees was between myself and the driver, so there was virtually nothing of a vehicle in front. And I was standing up, holding on to the front. There's no hood over the top. Staring over the front like that, when the wheel immediately underneath me hit mine. It was a hell of a blast. It seemed to go up my nose and hell of a blast. I knew immediately what had happened. I knew immediately what had happened. I was standing, and my driver was sitting there. I was standing, and it seemed as if they'd absolutely filmed me. And I heard my crew on the back shouting, "Sarge, Sarge, are you all right, Sarge? Sarge, are you all right?" And I couldn't speak. I could hear them. I knew what had happened. And I could not speak for a few seconds. And when I did, it was to tell them to be bloody quiet, because this was a night attack, and, you know, you weren't meant to, which is ridiculous, because other vehicles were also coming unstuck. Someone, unfortunately, tried to follow me and shortcut the corner we were taking and went up our mines. But so I unhooked, took our gun off portee, and the gun crew in front, they had their gun on portee, and I was able to hook mine up behind. And so we now doubled up, had a double crew, except for my driver. He stayed with the vehicle. And at this particular point, and at about this time, we actually broke through the line. At that particular spot, the armoured cars were the first through. The armoured cars from the Corps were the first through. We got a gap. It was the Italian part of the line and went through. And just before first light in the morning, my troop went through. We went through. And we went, carried on through the day, advancing out in front. And we were fairly well up, if you like, in the advance. But just ahead of us were the armoured cars, as they always were. We got used to this later on. Armoured cars out in front, they'd probably be a couple of miles out in front, a few of them. And there were just hundreds and hundreds of Italians walking in groups. We were going passing through them, literally hundreds of them. And I can still remember, it wasn't my portee, it wasn't my stuff on there. I and the rest of my crew were on there now, and we doubled up on this one portee. And they were asking for water, these Italians, that was the one thing they were asking for. Water, hundreds of them. How long it took some of them to reach somewhere where they were given water, I don't know. But of course, you couldn't give them water. You limited amount you've got, you looked after it. And if you'd have stopped them, which we weren't allowed to do, of course, you'd have been surrounded by them in no time. We then followed the advance, swinging to the right to fetch us up in the direction of a place called Fuca. Fuka, El Fuca. That evening, just as it got dark, we were up with the lead of the column, if you like, all together. We were up there, we fetched up onto this airfield, the corner of an airfield at Fuka.
Had you been injured in this blast?
No. No, you talked about when the mine exploded. Oh, no, I wasn't physically injured. No. I'd just been rendered speechless for a few seconds. Absolutely. And, we fetched up on the corner of this airfield for the night, where we would stay for the night. And we were ordered to stand to before first light in the morning, which was standard practice, stand to in the evening and stand to in the morning at the standard. We always did that. And we were standing to. The first little specks of light were appearing, if you like, from the east, when we heard an aircraft engine start up, now getting light, and this, you could hear this aircraft roar off, and I was on the corner of the airfield. Just in time, I jumped up on top of the portee, and you could just make out the aircraft. This airfield was on the top of a cliff, if you like. And I just in time to see the aircraft go off the edge of the cliff, and he turned left and flew along towards the German lines, if you like, over the sea. So he'd been sat there all night. All night he'd sat on that airfield. And as it started to get light in the morning, they got the engine started and away. So he, whoever it was, I don't know, and how many were with the aircraft. It was obviously only a single engine aircraft. Could have been two in it when it went. But they'd been sat there and sat there all night, surrounded, if you like, by British troops. Yeah. So whoever he was, that pilot, I don't know, but that will be recorded somewhere, no doubt, in the German archives. But he sat there all night. And from there on, of course, it was the... We took part in all sorts of things, being corps troops, if you like. And normally the corps commanders would like to kept good corps troops. They didn't want... They were people that they could depend on. They could send them. They wouldn't come back with a bad reputation after, say, serving in an action with this division or that division. And we got to know all the divisions, if you like. We'd already got been to several of them at the Alamein position, different times. New Zealanders, 51st Island Division, 7th Armoured. We knew them all. At different times we were assigned to some of them. But yes, we now took part in the advance along the North Africa coastline. I say coastline, there's only one road runs the whole length of North Africa at that time, just one coast road. We took part in all the main actions in the advance, including going out into the desert in summer, Montgomery's famous left hooks, as they were called. You go out in the desert and back to the coast road again, so hoping to trap this kind of thing. I'm trying to think of some of the more memorable events. Obviously, back when we were back home, we kept up with the news, and especially, of course, I did, having a brother who was serving out there. unfortunately, he was killed in November 41. But so we got everybody back home saw these little maps that were drawn from time to time with the advances and retirements from the desert campaign. You got to know about Benghazi and all the other places like that, and you became familiar with the names. I remember one of the places we came to was Siloam. It's a little pass you had to go up. It's Siloam Pass, where in the previous year the guards had been heavily hammered by the Germans and had taken terrific casualties. There was also a place that had played a part in the advance to... My brother was killed in one of the advances to relieve Tobruk. Tobruk stayed where it was for a long while, you probably know. And one of these advances, my brother was serving with the Royal Horse Artillery. It was in that advance to relieve Tobruk that he was killed in the November. they successfully relieved Tobruk. The garrison were able to get out and that type of thing. But yes, I also saw Tobruk. We were on the coast road, and I was able to look down to where the military cemetery was, where my brother was interred, if you like, when I couldn't get down there. We were chasing hard on the heels of the Germans. So, yes, and I've never got there. I've never been there. Although I still haven't lost the ambition to perhaps one day do it. What can I say? We then went on to all the more famous known names at that time in the desert, Wadi Akrit. Yes, that was a bit of a sticky position for us, so I was placed in position there on the edge of the wadi. We went up, went there, approached it at night time, and I was given a position. The other guns in my troop were positioned in other places round about. In the morning, woke, stand to, just getting ourselves together, stand to, when some of our tanks wandered up to round the position. And we immediately came under heavy gunfire. We weren't dug in, we didn't have a trench, we didn't have anything. Fortunately, there was a lot of sand, soft sand about, and the tanks, I think, looking out of their periscopes and beams, could see what was happening, that they were bringing fire down on us, that they skedaddled out of the way. I mean, my little anti-tank gun wasn't so visible. We were off 40 at that time, and our lorries had been sent to the rear anyway, which was the normal habit. You got in a position, you dug a gun pit and sent your lorries to the rear till they were required, but we hadn't even had time to dig a gun pit that time. Anyway, that was just one of the things, and so we went on and did the advance to Tripoli. We were on a left hook to Tripoli while some went along the coast road, if you like, kept in the north. Together with the other core troops, we swung out into the desert to do a left, one of these left hooks, and come up towards Tripoli, and we came to a standstill just outside of Tripoli. Tripoli fell fairly easily, fairly quickly. And we took part in the victory parade in Tripoli itself. I know when we arrived there, we were on we'd run out of food completely. Yes, on the advance of Tripoli. It was rather an extended advance, and we were on low rations, even down onto, we'd been issued with emergency rations, but of course you get hungry, and ours, by the time we reached there, it disappeared. I remember that on the last morning when we came to a standstill outside Tripoli, we were down to just one tin of bully beef only, which I kept buried in sand to keep it cool, and in the morning we opened the tin of bully, and that was it. We had nothing else, and we weren't expecting to get any more rations until perhaps late that day or the next day. Having said that, we stood on the side of a track. RAF lorry started to arrive to occupy the airfield outside of Tripoli, and I remember standing there asking them if they had any biscuits or anything to spare. So that's how we were. However, having said that, Tripoli had fallen, and we were able to send people into Tripoli. The lorry would take a couple off each gun crew and take them into Tripoli, and there they were able to buy dates. These dates were cut from large blocks of dates on a barrel in the street, and yes, so now we were eating from these blocks of dates which they brought back with them. And yes, we did take part in the victory parade through Tripoli itself. I don't know how long we stayed in that position. I know at night time we used to watch the terrific firework display which took place. The Germans used to be sending bombers to try to hit the shipping in Tripoli Harbour. The harbour itself was nearly surrounded. The inner harbour was nearly surrounded by a concrete wall on which we had mounted lots of AGAC guns, boofers and whatever. And so at night time, when he used to send his bombers over, there was a terrific display of AKAK fire crisscrossing over the harbour. Huge number of shells were exploded every night, virtually. He was trying every night to raid the place. Anyway, on to the next part of our advance. We were sent to face a strong German position, which was the Marath Mountains, the Marath Line, if you like. We were positioned in front of a small place called Medellin in the Marath line, our anti-tank guns were scattered to cover a fairly large area. And a day or so later, we were joined by the New Zealand Brigade. Our particular part was occupied by the New Zealand Māoris. And what startled us was the fact that we were overlooked by the main Marath Mountains, if you like, across a long wadi. I referred to it previously as being a valley, but people will picture the valley and talk about a wadi. They probably won't realise that that is, in fact, the valleys in the way we refer to the valleys in the desert. And yes, we were overlooked by these mountains and obviously could be observed. And so our movements during the day was very restricted. But on this morning that the first of the New Zealanders arrived, particularly their Māori company, they did no more. They had a rugby ball out on the positions and were kicking a rugby ball about, much to our amazement. Anyway, we found out they turned out to be lovely people, very generous they were. They would give us some of their rations, pots of jam and tins of jam and things like that. And my position was up on part of the small escarpment. I was facing across the main wadi towards the main German positions on the Marath Mountains. We were expecting the Germans to attack. They had, in the recent past, attacked the Americans, I believe, at what was called Kasserine Pass, and had picked up quite a lot of American equipment, tanks, I believe, vehicles, and you name it. They did mount the attack. It rained in that, so we were in that position. The only people in front of me, about 50 yards in front of my particular gun position, was an artillery observation, or artillery observation post. They were in a small pit. It rained very heavily this one night, very heavily. And come the morning, there was a thick mist over the old area, particularly in the valley or in the wadi down below. My battery mount commander was doing his rounds of us gun crews who were doing the dawn stand too. The battery commander with the battery captain arrived on my position, and whilst he was speaking to us to tell us they were expecting the German attack any time, we heard the sound of tank tracks coming from the front. From forward. We knew there were none of our tanks there, and the battery commander, I still remember him saying, "That's tanks." And I said, "Yes, sir, that's tanks." And he said, "Come on," to the captain. Obviously, off they went to back to battery HQ. As the mist began to clear, with the sun getting up, so we started to take a bit of gunfire coming in from the German side. I could look out across the escarpment as it was getting light, and I could see a lot of German vehicles coming towards us, mostly following one route. I wanted to know where they were going because I could hear tank tracks coming from below the escarpment immediately in front of us, which would be about 300 or 400 yards in front of us. And I couldn't see them because they were hidden by the fact that we were on this rise, and they were obviously down from where I couldn't see them. So I left my gun position, which was well camouflaged, and walked in the direction from which I could hear most of the noise coming, which was to my right, where the escarpment ended. And as I got there, so gunfire started. We had some of the anti-tank guns from my battery were positioned down off the end of that escarpment. A dummy minefield had been laid by our engineers with tape forcing anybody coming from the German position towards our anti-tank guns. This was a very good ploy, and it was working. I stayed just long enough to see a couple of German tanks knocked out. I could see our guns firing. I then immediately returned to my own gun pit, where I should have stayed anyway. And really, I just had a grandstand view without being able to to take part in the battle itself. I observed German 88mm guns being brought forward and placed in position and firing. Eventually the heat haze took over and obliterated some of what was going on. And I'd seen two groups of German tanks, about 20 in each group, at that time when our anti-tank guns were firing at them. And yes, really, I had just a grandstand view of a lot of this without actually being directly involved. Yes, directly involved is probably the wrong word. Things cooled off and quietened down a bit. Yes, you could see the smoke coming up off the German tanks. And we got to hear that we'd had some casualties in my battery. Yes, some of those on the guns. Later on in the day, evening time, when the heat haze disappeared to a certain extent, the next thing what we saw was a long line of German infantry stretching from as far to the left as we could see in front of our escarpment, up the valley, up the wadi, if you like, and to our right. Just one long line of German infantry walking forward towards us. It wasn't long before our artillery opened fire on registered targets in the valley. Parts. I saw a whole... Some of them, they were very close to the infantry, and we heard afterwards a lot of them were coming forward, a lot of Hitler youth. They were actually linked arms and singing as they came forward. Just one long line of them coming forward. Unbelievable sight. I saw whole chunks of them taken out by our artillery, where on registered parts of the valley, they were able to... They knew... I mean, they obviously aimed and fired shots on parts of the valley so that at any time they could bring concentrated fire down. This is a type of artillery tactic, if you like, which was common and would still be used today, where you register targets and can bring your fire to bear on them. Anyway, yes, and these infantry, those that weren't knocked out by our artillery fire, carried on walking forward until they too disappeared in front below this escarpment, a few hundred yards in front. A counterattack was mounted, and eventually our infantry cleared it. These New Zealand infantry cleared these people. They picked up. A lot of them were Hitler youth. A lot of them were very young. A lot of them, they went and found them actually asleep in that, once they got to that point. Obviously, they'd been on the go all day. And... yes, that was the end of the big German attack. It was a big German attack, and it was the end of their big German attack.
Do you think the Hitler Youth were advancing with linked arms?
Oh, yes. They were that close. I mean, this was almost a solid line coming towards us. It's something I never again saw, but other people who were able to observe that would back that they were coming forward in close order. Just one long line. Very close to each other, yeah. Eventually, it was in there. We were assigned to another part, the front, for an attack that was going to go in. That was the guards. I don't know what guards they were, but the guards' brigade were making an attack on a series of three small hills in front of this valley, to the right of this position where we'd been with the New Zealanders. My troop were assigned to support that attack. The way in which you support it is to run in onto a piece of the ground that's being attacked and dig in so that you can then protect the position from a counter-attack, especially if tanks are used. That's the way in which we support tanks at that time. We were assigned to support this attack by the guards. This night, it was going to be a night attack on these three small